Okay, so let's get back to the suttas again. So this the next sutta is also kind of an overview sutta to give a little bit of background more. And then once this sutta is finished, we're going to have a look at one which is more about meditation practice. And the idea behind that is just to reinforce some of the things I said yesterday about meditation, basically the structure of meditation and that sort of thing. Before we do that, just this other little sutta, which is quite striking sutta about the dangers in not, actually dangers about not reading the sutta, this is what this is about actually. So this is called Future Perils, and this is almost like the Buddha looking, peering into the dangers that may arise in the future as a result of wrong practice and this kind of thing. So this is what he has to say here. Again, in the future, there will be bhikkhus who are undeveloped in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom. When those discourses spoken by the Tathagata are being recited and are deep, deep in meaning, world-transcending, connected with emptiness, they will not want to listen to them, will not lend an ear to them, or apply their minds to understand them. They will not think those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those discourses are being recited that are mere poetry, composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, they will want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, and apply their minds to understand them. They will think those teachings should be studied and learned. Thus, because through the corruption of the Dhamma comes corruption of the discipline. And from the corruption of the discipline comes the corruption of the Dhamma. And this is the fourth future peril as yet unarisen that will arise in the future. You should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. So here we have this. This is actually very pertinent, I think, and very it actually goes to the heart of so much that we actually see today in the Buddhist world. This is exactly one of those problems. And it's kind of remarkable that here's the Buddha sitting 2,500 years ago, and he's speaking precisely to the problems that we have in the present day. That's quite astonishing here. So obviously there are certain things, certain typical things that came to happen, and you don't actually have to be able to see the future to understand this, but this is obviously almost like a natural law that these kind of things tend to happen. So what you have here is you have the bhikkhus, right, who are, I guess, anyone really, but especially the bhikkhus perhaps, who are undeveloped in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom. And undeveloped in body does not have anything to do with going to the gym or not going to the gym. That's what it may sound like. Undeveloped in body, kaya bhavana here, is a strange expression because it sounds almost like it's about developing the physical body, but what it actually refers to is the development of sense restraint. So so many of the things in the sutta, they are kind of, it's very hard to understand them just at first sight, and you have to cross-reference to other suttas to really know what is going on. So here, body has a kind of broader idea, it's broader in scope than just the physical body. The Pali word is kaya, and kaya certainly refers to the physical body, but it's also much broader in scope than that. It also includes the mind, or certain aspects of the mind. And this is part of what, almost like personality, developed in personality, is what it actually refers to here. And this is very interesting, because it's important understanding when you read the suttas to understand how these words are used in Pali. They're often used quite differently from how we use them in, you know, whether it's English or German or Norwegian or whatever language that you speak. And they have a different kind of emphasis to them. And kaya really means like, it means like, actually just like in English, a body can be a body of evidence or a, you know, it can mean a corporate body or something like that. It can mean an accumulation of things. In the same way, kaya, the root meaning, is a heaping up of things, an accumulation of phenomena. And in particular, it can mean the physical body as an accumulation of phenomena, or it can mean the personality of a person as an accumulation of various aspects, right? Kaya. And it may perhaps seem mysterious to you why I'm spending so much time explaining this, but the reason is that there are places in the suttas where these words are used very unusually. And if you read it in the wrong way, you get completely the wrong understanding of what is going on. And I'll just give you one example straight away, just to kind of show you what I'm talking about, because without example, it's very hard to understand what is going on. And the typical example is when you come to the third jhana, right? The jhanas, these are the profound stages of samadhi on the Buddhist path. And I'll probably talk about those later on. But in the third jhana, it says that you, kāyena sukkaṁ patisaṁvedeti. And if you translate that kāya there as meaning body, you actually get the meaning he experiences, or that person experiences happiness with the body. Yeah, so it sounds like it's a physical kind of happiness. But once you understand that kāya has a much broader scope than that, it actually allows, not only allows, it necessitates a completely different interpretation, and that is that you have an immediate experience of happiness. Kāya means a personal experience. You experience happiness directly, is really what it refers to in that kind of situation. Yeah, so this is the kind of thing, if you sometimes go on internet forums and you see how people talk about it, this is the kind of thing that gets discussed at great length, kind of page after page. People spend hours, days, lifetimes discussing these things. You're supposed to end samsara, but you're actually prolonging samsara by discussing this kind of issues forever. This is one of the problems with the internet forums. So that is a very important point, right? It's a very small and kind of, it may seem very innocuous thing, but actually some of these innocuous things can have very broad ramifications if you interpret them wrongly. So just to make that point, so undeveloped in body, it already has a kind of slightly strange ring when you see it like that. And then of course, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, we know what that is. That's pretty obvious. The Pali word here is sila, and the Pali word for sila is very broad. It means like, it almost has a kind of the meaning of character in Pali, so undeveloped in your character, undeveloped in your personality. What kind of person are you? Are you good-hearted? Are you mean, perhaps? I'm sure there's nobody mean in here, right? But these are the kind of words we use to define a personality, good-hearted person, a mean person, these kind of things. Or maybe whatever it is. So this is kind of one of the meanings of sila. It has this very broad kind of idea of what virtue is about. And I'm going to talk a lot about this later on, this idea of sila, because it is absolutely foundational for the entire Buddhist practice. And then we have the idea of being developed in mind, and cittang abhavita citta, and that means that you haven't really attained any samadhi yet. Your meditation isn't all that profound. And the last one being developed in wisdom. And this, of course, is the highest kind of development on the Buddhist path. The idea of having insight into the natural phenomena, especially the phenomena of the mind and the personal phenomena in that way. So this is almost like the entire Buddhist path there, summarized. We can see how that whole is a summary of the path. What is one little point that is also very interesting about this, when you see four factors like this, body, then virtuous behavior, then mind, and then wisdom. When these things occur in a sequence like that, it is not random, right? Everything in the sutta is very carefully structured. So when you see things occurring in that sort of sequence, that is because that sequence itself has a certain meaning. And it's always like that. Everything in the sutta is like that. For example, you have like the five hindrances, right? The panchanivarana. Now the five hindrances, it may seem like they are just five separate aspects that hinder you on the path. But actually it's not just five aspects, it's actually a particular sequence of those aspects. Starting with kama chanda, which is sensual desire, and then going to doubt. And that sequence itself is relevant or is significant for how to interpret these things. Or we have the five khandhas. The five khandhas are often translated as the five aspects of personality. The five personality aspects. And that too is significant. There's a sequence to that. There's a reason why it starts off with the body, then goes to Vedana, then ends up with Vijnana or consciousness at the end. This is not random. And everything on the Buddhist path is like that. And when you recognize that, it enriches the way you read the suttas, because everything is meaningful. Everything stands in relationship to something else. And everything has a kind of structure. we see later on that one of the nice things that Buddha says about his own suttas is that it's svakatoha. Svakato means suakata. Suakata means well expounded. Yeah? And well expounded means that it is meaningful. It is not kind of haphazard. It's not random. It is structured. Everything is structured. Everything has kind of a relationship to each other. Yeah? And when you read it like that, wow, the meaning really comes out in a very powerful way. I'm going to talk more about that later on, because that's actually a very interesting part of the Dhamma in its own right. But now I'm going to move on, otherwise we get stuck at this particular point for a long time. So then we have here the description of those discourses spoken by the Tathagata, by the Buddha again, that are deep, right? Deep here means especially what is meant by that is things like non-self. Non-self or dependent origination, if you like, these are two aspects of the same coin. So this is what is meant by deep here. They're kind of hard to fathom properly for ordinary people. And actually, this is very true. It is very hard to fathom. If you ask an ordinary person the meaning of Nibbana, what does Nibbana mean? They find it very hard to really get the head around that. And the reason why it is so hard to get your head around it is because that you haven't actually understood the idea of non-self, anatta. It is only when in the context of anatta that something like Nibbana actually makes any sense. Yeah, so I don't know if you're interested, we can talk about all of these things as part of this retreat, but it really depends on we'll see how things go. Deep in meaning, so there's a deep teaching, deep in meaning, in other words, points to profound results, and it is world-transcending. Lokuttara is the Pali word for world transcending here. It is, goes beyond, entirely beyond the ordinary world that we are used to. And the world here, of course, means the world of our personal experience. It goes entirely beyond our personal experience. Everything is left behind. Nothing left at all. Now we have the last one, which is really the nicest one of all, and that is connected with emptiness. Pali is sunyata pati sanyuta. And sunyata, this word emptiness, of course, a very Buddhist teaching, very famous for the word emptiness. You hear that especially in Mahayana Buddhism, but you also find it in the early suttas. Yeah, right here. It's right here. Also in the what we call the EBTs, sometimes the early Buddhist text. It is found there as well. The meaning is roughly the same, whether you go to the Mahayana Suttas or the Theravada, it's roughly the same, but slightly different nuance on what it means. So the idea of sunyata is that there is no core, right? There is no essence. There is nothing there in the end. You go inside, it's like an onion. You peel off the layers and you go inside to the next one, and eventually you reach the very core, and there's nothing there. The last layer gets peeled off, gone. There's nothing left at all. This is the idea of emptiness, and it's a very nice way of getting your head around a little bit the idea of non-self, what it actually means. The world is empty. Is that nice or is that bad? Good or bad? What do you think? The world is empty here. Kind of cool, isn't it? Empty. I think it's empty here. It's very nice. And one of the problems with many of these words, like non-self and emptiness, sometimes it seems very challenging here. What do you mean non-self? I want to be here. I want to exist. I want to experience. This is a natural that we should feel that way, because we have a very strong vested interest in our identity. So of course we think like that. But one of the ways of getting our kind of emotions and heads around this, understanding this, maybe I can talk about that straight away, is to look at your meditation experience. And when you start to look at your meditation experience, even at the very beginning when you kind of start out, one of the things that you find is that when things fade away and disappear, what happens? You tend to feel better, right? When you sit down and you kind of really relax and the body starts to fade away, what does it feel like when the body fades away? It feels quite nice, actually, and you realize that the body is a bit of a pain. Yeah, and then the mind starts to become peaceful, you don't think so much anymore. And what is it like to have a peaceful mind compared to having a very agitated and restless mind? It is so nice to feel peaceful, right? But actually, when you feel peaceful, when there's less thinking going on, there's less of you there at the same time. Because you, part of the you, is the kind of habitual thinking pattern. It is driven by the sense of self, yeah? Because you want to you want to kind of feel your own presence, or you want to justify yourself, or whatever it is. It's a very powerful expression of the self, the thinking mind, that when that dies down, there is less of you there. There's more non-self and less self. The body disappears. The senses start to disappear. The five hindrances go away. There's less and less going on. There's more and more non-self. Yeah. What does it feel like? It feels really good. It's really nice. And this is one way of getting your kind of your head around this idea of non-self. Why it is so beautiful and why it is so powerful. Because it actually, you can feel that right now in your present experience. The less sense of self there is, the better you feel about yourself. It's a bit of a conundrum, isn't it? So you feel better, basically, whether it's self or not, just by experiencing the fading away and the ending of things. So notice that, because then you start to get this idea that non-self is actually very beautiful, very powerful, very wonderful teaching. It actually works. It works right here, right now, in your personal experience. So check it out. And if it doesn't work, come back to me and complain later on. Okay. So that is the idea of sunyata patisangyuta, yeah? And of course then, these monks who haven't really developed the path properly, then what happens is that they're not interested, they won't listen to these things, they won't lend an ear, they won't apply their mind and say, oh, whatever, yeah, the same old Buddhas, even the same old teachings, I'm not really interested in that. And they don't think that those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those discourses are being recited, that are poetry, composed by poets, hooray! Beautiful in words and phrases created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, then they will listen, then they will lend an ear, then they will apply their minds to understand. Yeah, poetry, oh, so beautiful, so nice, nice cadences, nice rhyming at the end of each sentence, rise kind of, you know, meter for each line. Wow, it is so beautiful. And this is what life is often like. You want to hear something. It's almost like an aspect of sensual pleasure when you hear a nicely composed verse. It has a sensual feel to it, right? It feels just nice. And very often, as human beings, we tend to go to those things that are beautiful. And whether it is really profound, whether it is really connected with emptiness or not, is not so important, because we can't really relate to emptiness anyway. Emptiness, oh, whatever, this is at least, it's beautiful. I can feel the beauty of this here and now. Emptiness, that's for another day, sometime in the future. But this is our leaning as human beings. We always lean to those things that are beautiful and actually have a meaning for us in the here and now, instead of going for those things that actually may be truly profound. And this, I think, is one of the problems. And so often we tend to the poetry. Very often you see people, you know, it's not without reason that one of the most loved of all the Buddhist texts is the Dhammapada. Yeah, Dhammapada, often very, it is also very meaningful, of course, but also it is poetry. Yeah? And often the poetry, you read it in Pali especially, sometimes also in translation. It is very, it's very inspiring. It comes out in a very nice way. Yeah? But of course, some of the most important suttas and teachings of the Buddha are not found in the Dhammapada, not found in the verse. They're actually found in the prose sections of the suttas. And this is an important distinction that is always, I think, important to keep in mind, is that the where you can expect to find the most profound, the most important teachings of the Buddha is not in the verse. It's not in the poetry, it's in the prose section of the suttas. Why is that? It is because when you have verse, you are restricted to what you can say, because verse has certain meter that you have to follow, there's certain strictures on what you can say because of that. Yeah? But when you write prose, or when the Buddha declares things in prose, and there's no restrictions on what you can say, and because of that, you can be far more precise in how you deliver the Dhamma. Huh? Yeah, so keep that in mind. So what that means, you're much more likely to find the really profound and accurate teachings in the prose parts, the sort of things that we're reading now and we're reading this morning, rather in the verse parts. The verse is more for inspiration. Yeah, you read a beautiful verse, you're, wow, so inspiring, so nice. So it's good for inspiration, but not quite as good for your accurate description of the Dhamma. And I think this is an important thing to keep in mind. Anyway, so this is the the verses created by outsiders, right? Sometimes I hear about even Buddhist monks who are more interested in reading the kind of some other about some other religion, like maybe the maybe the Advaita Vedanta or something like that, and less interest in actually the suttas of the Buddha, and also spoken by disciples. This to me is one of the most profound aspects of this particular sutta, this idea that people tend to go towards that is spoken by disciples rather than what is spoken by the Buddha. Because if you think about the Buddhist world today, that is exactly what is happening. If you ask any Buddhist, maybe even if you ask me sometimes, if you ask almost any Buddhist, you ask, who is your teacher? And they will say, oh, it is Bhante so-and-so, Aya so-and-so, Venerable so-and-so, Sayado so-and-so, Lama so-and-so, Bhante, you know, whatever. It is all of these different possibilities, or maybe even Mr. so-and-so or Mrs. so-and-so. Everybody is included these days, of course. But the one person that is never included is the Buddha. Everybody has anyone as a teacher except the Buddha. The Buddha is the one that is always missing here. How often have you asked somebody and they said, the Buddha is my teacher? Has it ever happened before to you? Hasn't really happened to me. I've been a Buddhist monk for now over 20 years. It still hasn't happened. Except when I look myself in the mirror and ask myself, who is your teacher? But even then, I used to say Ajahn Brahm, right? I said, no way! Not Ajahn Brahm, the Buddha, for goodness sake. Get it right. And so this is kind of the point, is that the root teacher, not the root, maybe the root guru, that's a kind of Tibetan expression, maybe we can use that here, because we're in Tibetan place, the root guru, the root teacher should always be the Buddha. You come back to the Buddha, that is the most profound, where you can expect to find the most profound teachings. That is where you can expect to find the most accurate description of the Dhamma. It doesn't mean you cannot listen to anyone else. Of course you can. If you couldn't, I should be leaving pretty much straight away. You can listen to other teachers as well, but you have the gold standard. You have the thing against which everything else should be measured. And that is the teachings of the Buddha. And this is so important and so significant. When you go around the Buddhist world today and you go to monasteries everywhere, you go to, I've been around quite a bit now because that's what happens when you become a senior, fairly senior monk. And you travel around and you see the Tipitaka, right? These books right here. And you see them encased in a nice cupboard. It has a glass front and then the cupboard has a lock on it. And nobody really knows where the key is to this cupboard, right? And every morning the monks come out and they bow down to these books. Oh, sadhu, 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 the holy books of the Buddha. But nobody ever opens those books at all. And this is a problem. This is what the Buddhist world is a bit like these days. And then you ask them, well, who is your teacher? If the suttas are locked up behind this cupboard, oh, my teacher is Venerable so-and-so, Ajahn so-and-so, that's my teacher. Okay. So this is the... this is a problem, and what is of course very interesting about this is that the Buddha foresaw how this would happen 2,500 years ago, which is very fascinating. So please keep that in mind, because the problem with this, and this is what the Buddha is saying here, is actually it is detrimental. It leads to decline, the dangers, the peril for Buddhism when these things happen. Okay, and then at the very last here, it says that when there is a corruption of the Dhamma, comes the corruption of the discipline, and vice versa, corruption of the discipline comes the corruption of the Dhamma. And I'm just going to comment on that just a little bit, because what is meant by Dhamma, what is meant by discipline, the word for discipline is Vinaya, Dhamma, first of all, Dhamma means the doctrine, it means the teachings of the Buddha. It basically means this here, what the Buddha taught, that's the Dhamma. So it is a doctrine, whereas the word Vinaya is quite an interesting word in the Pali Suttas, because the Vinaya eventually comes to mean all the rules and all the regulations that the monastics are supposed to follow. So we have a Vinaya Pitaka, right? Vinaya basket of conduct, they often call that. But in the suttas, it doesn't actually mean that, because in the suttas, the time of the Buddha, there wasn't any Vinaya Pitaka yet. It didn't actually exist. So the word Vinaya has kind of evolved over time. And the earliest meaning of the word Vinaya is like training. So you have the idea of Vinaya is like you train, you have the doctrine, which is the teaching of the Buddha, and then you have the training that corresponds to that teaching. In other words, how you apply those teachings. So it is like theory and praxis, yeah? Doctrine and application of the doctrine. This is what it means. So then you can see it makes quite good sense, right? So when the Dhamma gets distorted or corrupted, then of course when the teaching is corrupted, the practice gets corrupted. And when the praxis is corrupted, in other words, you don't apply yourself in the right way, you don't realize those teachings. And because of that, the teaching gets corrupted. So these two things go hand in hand. And this again is why it is so important that we keep on practicing, that we keep on having Aryas in the world, the noble ones who realize these things. Because they are ultimately the upholders of these teachings, the ones who actually make these things come alive and help us to understand them in the right way. Okay, so that is the future peril sutta. So now let us move on. The next sutta is called Volition, and this is from the Anguttara Nikaya. So actually, maybe I should show you what this is. The Anguttara Nikaya right here, right? This is the Anguttara Nikaya. So these are called the numerical discourses, and this is the English translation of it, and this is where it is. This is where you find this particular sutta. So you can see it says 11.2. So 11 means this Anguttara Nikaya is divided into books from 1 to 11. So this is the very last book, and it's the second sutta in the very last book. So there it is, Volition, right there, towards the end. Okay, anyway, we can maybe look at those a bit more later on. This particular sutta is about meditation practice and about how meditation practice ideally is experienced in the first person. In other words, what it feels like when meditation goes well. This is what the sutta is about. But before I talk about this sutta, I just want to say something about how do we decide whether a particular sutta is important or not. Is there any criteria for deciding these things? The answer is yes, there is such a criteria. And one of the ways of doing that, of course, is that we had a look this morning when the Buddha says that the essence of his teaching is the 37 Bodhipakyadhammas, the 37 aids to awakening. So, of course, anything that fits straight into those 37 Bodhipakyadhammas will be an important teaching, right? Because it is right there. It is part and parcel of what the Buddha has laid down as his teachings. So one of the first questions we can ask ourselves, this teaching, does it fit into those 37 Bodhipakyadhammas? This is one way of doing that. And does it fit in? And I can tell you straight away that it does fit in very nicely, because this is very similar to the Bodhjhangas, the factors of awakening. It's a very similar kind of structure to that. So because of that, it is kind of fits into the general framework. It's a slightly variation on the theme of the Bodhjhangas, but essentially it is the same idea as the factors of awakening here. That is one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at what are the important suttas is to ask yourself, how often is a particular sutta taught, right? If it is taught very frequently to different audiences in different places, and maybe with slight variations on the theme, yeah, slightly different depending on where it is taught. Those suttas that are taught often, obviously, they will have to be important. Otherwise, the Buddha wouldn't bother teaching them all the time. So there's another way of deciding this. And this particular sutta we're looking at now is one of those themes that kind of run through the suttas. Again and again and again, you see this particular theme. And this is why how you can decide that this actually is an important teaching here. One of the things about the suttas is that very often the thing that people get stuck into and argue about, very often it is marginal teachings, teachings that occur maybe once or twice. And of course the reason why people argue about them is precisely because they are quite marginal, because they are rare, so there's something to talk about. If something is very common, usually has already been sorted out, it is those rare teachings that you kind of end up arguing and discussing. So for that reason, it is one of the kind of great principles. This was a principle enunciated by the famous German monk Jana Ponika, Therese. You know Jana Ponika? Yeah, famous German monk. Yeah, who died It's quite a while ago now, 94 or something like that. No, later than that, maybe 97, something like that. And he was very well studied, and he wrote some of the very important books on meditation and many other things, and of course a lot of translation into German and English as well. And he said that when you read the suttas, you should take as your main teaching those suttas that you see again and again and again, and leave aside those rare teachings that only occur every now and again here. So this is straight from Venerable Jana Ponika. And where did I hear? That was Ajahn Brahm, I think. Ajahn Brahm went to Sri Lanka back in the early 90s. He went to visit Venerable Jana Ponika, and this is kind of one of the teachings that he gave him while he was there. So there you are. This is one of the great kind of scholars, if you like, of the last century who said this. So there is that. There's actually some very interesting German monks around the world. Some of them have died or passed away. We'll be talking a bit more about those later on, because they're very inspiring here and very kind of interesting here. Actually, some very interesting German nuns as well. Actually, not just monks, but also nuns, which also is quite is really good. But that is for a later time. So now let us actually get into the sutta itself, and I'll just read it out and comment as usual about what is going on. So bhikkhus. Okay, so let's stop there. Right, first word. Let's not go too fast, otherwise you might. No, so bhikkhus, this is an important thing to actually discuss, because sometimes when it says bhikkhus like that, people say, what about me? I'm not a bhikkhu. You know, I'm the only bhikkhu here, actually, so it's only for me, so I don't really have to read it out to anyone. That would be unfair if I did that. So the point here, and this is kind of part of the conventions in ancient India, is that you speak to the most senior members of the assembly. And usually the bhikkhus would be the most senior members, because they had been around from the very beginning and would be the most kind of original disciples of the Buddha. So the Buddha would always speak to the earliest disciples. And you see this throughout the suttas. For example, there will be a group of bhikkhus, and the Buddha is addressing those bhikkhus. He will actually speak to the most senior of the monks present. So he will, for example, he will say Anuruddhas. And Anuruddhas would then be speaking to them, using the name of Anuruddha, to talk to the entire assembly that is present. And very often these assemblies will be much more than just the bhikkhus. There will be the bhikkhunis there. There will be the lay people there as well. Yeah, they will be a part of the assembly. So please don't feel left out when I read this suttas. You are part of this as well. Yeah, so that is an important thing. Sometimes people think, what about me? I want to be part of this too. And that is, please don't think that, because actually these things are for everybody. And that's why I stopped there on the very on bhikkhus. So bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, and lay followers. For a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition need be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in one who is virtuous, one whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, no volition need be exerted. Let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no volition need be exerted. Let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one with a rapturous mind, no volition need be exerted. Let my body become tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no volition need be exerted. Let me feel pleasure. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, no volition need be exerted. Let my mind be stilled. It is natural that the mind of one feeling pleasure is stilled. For one who is stilled, no volition need be exerted. Let me know and see things as they really are. It is natural that one who is stilled knows and sees things as they really are. So there you are. So, what do you think? Interesting? Boring? Repetitive? Yeah? Sometimes when I ask people, what do you think? Like, oh, so boring, so repetitive, so uninteresting. And this is the nature of the suttas. Often they are like this. They are very repetitive. And once you get used to the idea of the repetition, used to the idea of how these things are structured, actually it becomes very nice. And the reason why it is nice is because it makes the most important element in each section stand out. Right? When you read this, it's very obvious what the important element is. First you have joy, then you have rapture, then you have tranquility, then you have pleasure. That is the important element each time. Once you have the standard formula in place, everything else kind of comes out quite nicely, and you see what the important element is. And this is the nice thing about this. So it may seem boring initially, because we're not used to reading things in this way. It's not really meant for reading, it's meant for recitation anyway. But once you get used to it, it makes the, it stands out in a very powerful way. And remember that these texts are very different from reading a novel or reading a newspaper or anything like that. The purpose of these texts is to contemplate these things. To think about them more deeply. So if you have something which is repetitive in this way, after a while it starts to sink in. After a while, each of these elements, and also the very repetitive phrase itself, it becomes more meaningful, precisely because you are repeating it. So they actually have quite a nice function if you think about these things in the right way. So once you get past the kind of, oh, so boring part, then the next thing to think about, the next thing which is interesting about this, is that this is, as I said a minute ago, it's all about meditation experience. So this is what you might call the psychology of meditation. In other words, how we are supposed to experience meditation from a first-person point of view. So ideally, some of these things is what you will experience when you go on a retreat. So, and when you start to look at that list of what we are supposed to experience, it's really uplifting. If you look at these things, first of all, you have, well, let's forget about the very first one. Let's start with the second one, which is non-regret. That's already pretty good, right? If you have no regret, it's kind of your life is obviously enhanced if you have no regrets about anything. And then, after non-regret, you have this astonishing sequence of qualities, starting with joy. Then you have rapture. Then tranquility, deep sense of tranquility, you really, really, really chill out, right? Then you have pleasure. Then you have stillness, samadhi. I didn't say concentration, because if I said concentration, I noticed that Ayavimla is recording this. If Ajahn Brahm ever gets to hear this talk and I use the word concentration, I will be in serious trouble. So that's why I didn't use the word concentration. So stillness, right? This beautiful stillness that arises as you move deep into the samadhi on this path. And then finally, seeing things according to reality, which is another kind of happiness. It may not sound very happy, but of course, seeing things according to reality is also a very important part of happiness on this path. So what you are seeing here, what is so beautiful about this, is that the entire path of meditation, when it works properly, it's all about happiness, all about pleasurable feelings, one way or another. It is so uplifting. It is so kind of, wow, if this is what meditation is about, count me in, because I would like to experience all of these things. This is what I feel when I read this. I think this is just so beautiful, and so uplifting. And this is really kind of, and because meditation is, of course, a core aspect of the entire Buddhist path, it means that a core aspect of the Buddhist path is all about happiness. And it's so important to remember this, because one of the problems with the Buddhist teaching is that people often say, oh, so pessimistic, right? Dukkha here, dukkha there, everything is just dukkha. Except when you read this, it's all the exact opposite. It's all about sukha. And the way to bring this together, how on the one hand the entire teaching is about dukkha, at the same time about sukha, is to understand that the real understanding of dukkha is an insight into reality. It is not what we feel here and now, whether we feel suffering or not, and these kind of things. The real understanding of dukkha is about insight. And that is why there seems to be a conflict between the first noble truth of dukkha and this kind of explanation that we find here of the process of meditation itself. That actually there is no contradiction. It actually works out very well. It's just that the idea of dukkha is about insight into reality. It's not how we experience reality from moment to moment. It's about a broader outlook that has to do with insight. Yeah, so it's nice to remember that, because often people say, oh, Buddhism, you know, I don't really want to go into such a negative path. Actually, it's not negative at all. It's incredibly positive. If you ever wanted to be happy, if you ever wanted a path that leads to real happiness in life, this is it. Yeah, this is what the Buddha is saying here. This is what kind of the Buddha's marketing suit, maybe that's what we call instead of volition. So marketing the Buddhist practice of meditation. So, one of the important things is that there are so many words here for happiness and for pleasure in one way or another. It's important to untangle these a little bit and to understand what kind of happiness comes at what time and how it all fits together. I will do that in a second, because only then can you see this as a map, that map to show you whether you're heading in the right direction or not. Of course, the whole point of this is to give us a map so we know whether we're kind of heading in the right way or not. So that is the first point, or the second point, or the third point, or whatever. I can't remember anymore how many points I made already, but one of those points. But another very interesting point here is, of course, is this little phrase that you see there, where it says, no volition need be exerted. Yeah, this is a very interesting phrase. The Pali is na cetanaya karaniya, is the Pali word. And what that means, karaniya, na karaniya, means not to be done, cannot be done. And cetanaya is related to the word cetana, it means cannot be done by volition. Yeah, that's the actual meaning. So the translation here by my Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who I respect enormously for his translations, in this case, I think they are slightly, not quite accurate to the Pali. Na cetanaya karaniya literally means not cannot be done by volition, not to be done through volition. Not that volition need not be exerted. That's a little bit too weak, in my opinion. These things cannot happen through volition, cannot happen as an act of will. Volition means the will, yeah? Some of these words, I have to admit, are not words that are kind of commonly used in the English language, but the word will, the kind of the doer, the actor, right, being the agent in one's life, it is not done through agency. So, what does that mean? It isn't done through agency. And what it means is that this whole sequence is a natural sequence that unfolds according to the laws of nature. Once you get the sequence started, once you are kind of sitting back and not doing anything, the whole point here is the agency, the will, the volition actually gets in the way. You have to get rid of the agency. And once you do that in the right way, this unfolds according to nature. This is the point of this. Yeah, so it's so easy, right? You just sit back and wait. And as you sit back and wait, these things happen. This is the message here. And then people say, but that's what I'm doing. It's not happening. Why isn't it happening? I'm just sitting back and following instructions perfectly. Why isn't it actually going? And this is kind of the critical issue that we need to discuss next. Why isn't it happening if it's supposed to be a natural sequence? Actually, I should point out here that it says it right here. It is natural, right, that joy arises in one without regret. It is natural, etc., for each of these steps. In other words, it happens whether you want to be happy or not. Even if you want to be miserable, you're going to be happy. Yeah, don't have any choice. I think that's a pretty good deal. So you become happy whether you want to or not. This is kind of the interesting thing about this, that meditation, when it works properly, is not done through our agency, through our application of the will or anything like that. Is it done in exactly the opposite way? You withdraw the agency, you withdraw the will, and you allow the process to take its own course. Then all of these things happen. Yeah, and this is one of the reasons why I emphasize this idea of being the passenger on the train, of just sitting back and just watching and allowing things to be. Because when you do that, you are removing the agency from the situation. You're just trying to stand back, to allow things to be here. And what is so nice about that is that it is a very painless and very beautiful thing, a beautiful way of doing your meditation practice. All the agency, all the volition, always trying very hard to do A, to do B, often it becomes painful after a while. But just sitting back and just waiting and allowing things to be, and as a result of that, experiencing all the happiness in the world. Yeah, it's a pretty good deal, that's what I say. This is the best deal there is. There is no better deal than this. You just wait, and you stand back, and you allow things to arise, and you feel happiness as a consequence. Yeah, this is why I'm so keen on Buddhism. I'm just telling it to you guys. I'm seeing if you get as keen as I am, but I'm really keen on this. It's really beautiful. So this is one of the things that makes this so powerful. But of course, the question then arises, how do we get this thing started? Because a lot of people don't feel so much joy in the meditation. Of course, it is important to understand that even though you may not feel joy in meditation all the way, or even never, it doesn't mean that meditation is useless. Sometimes it can be useful just to kind of sit back and enjoy and relax and enjoy the present moment or whatever. That can also be very very useful, and you find at least some happiness, some benefit from meditation practice. But the real meditation, the meditation of the Buddha, encouraged us to move towards it. This is this, right? This is the real deal. So how do we get there? How do we do this if it is an automatic process? And of course, when you have an automatic process like this, a sequence, to find out what you have to do, you have to go to the end points of the sequence. It is the end points that show you how the sequence gets started and where it ends. And it shows you where the effort, if you like, needs to be placed to get the sequence going here. Yeah, so what is the starting point of the sequence? And the starting point is virtue. Yeah, again, this word sila that I mentioned before, the Pali word sila that I mentioned before. So that is the starting point. So if you want to know how to get this whole thing going, it is all about virtue. It is all about morality. It's all about your character. It's all about who you are as a human being. And the more you can develop that side of things, the more you can develop the sila aspect of things, the more naturally the sequence will take off. This is really what this means. Yeah. And maybe you think, oh, but I'm good already. I'm already keeping the 5 precepts, keeping the 8 precepts now. Yeah, maybe that's what you think. And fair enough, you probably are a very good person already. I have no doubt that you are. I think probably everyone here is a very good person. Otherwise, you wouldn't bother to be here in the first place. But remember, we are setting a very, very high bar here for what we mean by sila, what we mean by morality. It's a very, very high level. And the higher the bar is, and if you're able to clear a really high bar, it means that your chances of achieving the happiness in the meditation practice are far greater than if you don't clear those high bars. So keeping the 5 precepts, you're already doing really well if you live your life by those 5 precepts. And I congratulate you for doing that, because the vast majority of Buddhists in the world do not even keep the 5 precepts. Yes, I'm going to, if you don't keep the 5 precepts already, I will encourage you very, very strongly to do so, because this really is the foundation of everything in the Buddhist teachings. And there's a nice story from Thailand. This is another story that Ajahn Brahm tells from Thailand, from the early days when he was there back in the 1970s or whatever. And he tells this story of one of those, sometimes we have those big days when everybody comes together in the big monasteries. And Ajahn Brahm was living at Wat Pa Pong, that was Ajahn Chah's monasteries in those days. And Ajahn Chah was incredibly famous, right? He was known throughout Thailand. He died a few years later, and at his funeral there were 500,000 people or something coming to the funeral. So what a... 500,000 people coming to your funeral. Please leave me alone, I've died, don't come to me. You know, 500,000 people. Because he was so famous, and this was one of the big days, there were literally thousands of people coming to the monastery. This was the Vaisak day or something like that. Lots and lots of people coming to the monastery. And these were all the villagers living in the surrounding area, and all coming to see Ajahn Chah, because he was so inspiring and such a famous person at the time. And during this Vaisak talk, right, Ajahn Chah, he looks out on the assembly. And there were kind of people as far as the eye could see, right, literally. And then he asked them, how many of you keep the five precepts? Yeah. What massive assembly there. How many of you keep the five precepts? And then in this enormous assembly, according to the story, it's probably an exaggeration, because everything Ajahn Brahm said is slightly exaggerated, often massively exaggerated. According to Ram, two people raise their hands, right? Two people in all of these thousands of people raise their hands. And then you have to excuse the expression, but then Ajahn Chah, he looks out and he kind of tells the people, you are all, you know what you are. This is what he said, you are all dog shit, that's what you are. And dog, that's really bad in Thailand, right? That's the absolute lowest you can be, possibly, is kind of dog shit. So, and this tells you that sometimes, even though if you're part of a traditional Buddhist culture, or you have been kind of born as a Buddhist or whatever, often it doesn't necessarily mean that you're practicing all that well. So please, if you have a chance, if you feel that you are inspired by this teaching, please keep the five precepts as a very minimum. But if you want meditation to really take off and you really want to go deeper, you have to go beyond the five precepts. It is not enough. You have to put the bar much higher than that. And this is what this is really about. And this is why the meditation works for some people and it doesn't work for others. And what I mean by putting the bar higher, what I mean is that you cannot really do, first of all, you can't do bad things by body or speech, right? This is obviously number one. Second one is that not only can we not do bad things by body or speech, we should positively do good things by body and speech. We should do our very best to be kind to others in the way we act and the way we speak. By not doing the bad things, you're avoiding feeling bad about yourself. By positively, actively doing the good things, you're going to feel good about yourself. You feel, yeah, I'm living a good life. You sit down, you close your eyes, and you feel that you are worthy of happiness. You are worthy of all of these things because you know that you're living your life really well. And it's an internal feeling, it's a quiet feeling that you have within yourself. Nobody else may be aware of that, but you will feel that very strongly inside of yourself, that you're living well. And then there is the mental aspect of virtue. Remember, I was saying that sila is not just morality in the ordinary sense of the English language. It's about our entire character. So it's about how we think. It's about how we perceive, right? So it is about avoiding thinking the bad thoughts and positively developing the good thoughts. So after a while, your entire character becomes just goodness all the way through. And that is really what sila means here. And if you're able to develop that goodness all the way through your entire character, that is where meditation becomes automatic in the way that we see here. All you have to do is sit down, close your eyes, and you just feel really peaceful and still because you're happy about yourself. This is what we call the sila nusati in the Pali language. The recollection of your sila becomes an automatic process, and then the meditation takes off from there. Yeah, so this is really, if you are really committed to the Buddhist path, and this is how I try to live my life, I don't always kind of live up to these very high standards, but I try to live my life in this way. I try to, in such a way that I always even try to use my mind in a positive way as much as I possibly can. And when that starts to work, when that comes together, that is where meditation really becomes possible. So that hopefully gives you some idea of how this works. Now I want to very briefly, before I call it an end, we're getting close to the hour already, also have a look at the other end of this sequence of things, where it actually is leading to. The very last connection here is the idea that pleasure leads to stillness of the mind, it leads to samadhi. The last one is that stillness leads to knowing and seeing things according to reality, which I think may be a slightly better translation there. So stillness leads you to knowing and seeing things according to reality. And this is another very important and very interesting part of this particular sequence, because this is the sort of thing that actually you don't get to hear so often in the Buddhist world. So stillness, if you want to see things according to reality, which really, of course, is an outcome, what we're all trying to go on the Buddhist path, is all about vipassana, right? Here it's about yata bhuta, jnana dasana, knowledge and vision according to reality. So if you want to penetrate to the truth, if you want to see things, anicca, impermanence, suffering and non-self, all of these things that are there for our understanding, if we want that, we need one thing. What is that one thing? It's stillness. It's samadhi. Yeah, that is the thing that is required to actually see things in accordance with reality. And this is one of these things that once you start reading the suttas, you start reading the word of the Buddha very broadly, you see it everywhere, again and again and again, as you go through these things. You see this connection between seeing things according to reality and the stillness of the mind that precedes it. It's absolutely everywhere. So an extraordinarily important thing, which unfortunately people don't really get to hear about often enough. And what do we mean by samadhi? What does stillness mean in this particular case? When you read the suttas, sometimes there are different definitions of samadhi in the suttas. But there's one thing that comes back again and again and again, which is the kind of the standard definition of samadhi, the standard definition of samasamadhi in the suttas, and that is the four jhanas. Yeah, the four jhana states, this is kind of the most common, the most usual, and the most important part of samadhi experiences. So if you want to see things according to reality, normally you have to go through those jhanas in one way or another. You have to attain some kind of samadhi, otherwise it's not going to happen. This is what this says. So a very powerful statement there in the sutta. And again, it is something that you see throughout everywhere. The sutta then continues, and then it continues through another few layers until eventually it goes all the way to liberation. So the liberation of the mind is the final outcome of all of this, which of course is very nice. So this whole sequence, it ends up in liberation. But remember, the point, the reason why I'm bringing this out is partly just to show you what meditation really is about. So remember this, keep this at the back of your mind, because when you do that, you actually have a guidance and map for how these things work. You can see here, the deeper, the more profound the happiness of the path, the more you are leaning in the right direction. I should really have gone through all the elements one by one, but it's too late to do that now. Maybe we can do that later on or something. Okay, so that is all for now. I will see you again at 7:30 this evening. Until then, please continue enjoying yourself and try to experience some of the happiness of meditation.